A Davenport author comes home on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Ben Miller came to town to talk to the Writers' Conference. Today he'll chat with us on Scribble. Must have been something like old home week coming back to the Writers' Conference.
Yeah, I'd say so. I've already seen a couple people, two or three that I haven't seen in about 25, 30 years. The welcome has been immense and gracious, and it's so wonderful just to see also the architecture of the area and how it's changed. Everything from buildings going down to buildings going up, and in the middle of it all, that river that never changes, it keeps swirling and into our minds and imaginations.
Yeah, well, it kept swirling into our hearts this time.
You, on the other hand, Ben, have changed a little since I saw you as a squirt kid over at Augie at the Writers' Conference. You stood out because you were probably 30 years younger than anybody else there.
Absolutely. But
who's that kid? What's that kid doing here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I had the right glasses for being 40 years old. But besides that, I was not 40 years old. And those Augie conferences were part of the formulation of my core as a writer, really. Getting to meet not only the local writers who were so persistent and relentless in pursuing their craft, notably David R. Collins, but also writers from around the region would come to that conference. And I remember auctioning there with Rich Johnson,
right,
a wonderful fellow with a dry sense of humor and a great musical ability. And
Who almost finished the one book he wrote, and finished by BJ, who is no longer with us either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's, so a lot of the crowd that you mentioned there are, you know, have passed on, and but a few are still puttering around. You'd already decided, when did you decide to be a writer?
Well, you know, I mean, we were sort of talking about this recently, on the way over here with Sue Collins. And, you know, for writers, often begin in libraries. So I started going to the library at 5 and meeting Rochelle Murray. And there were two things I asked her for immediately. One was the address for the Scarecrow, Ray Bolger. And the second thing I asked her for was the address to Aaron Copland, the composer.
Whoa.
And I wrote two letters, one to Brooklyn, Aaron Copland, and the other to Ray Bolger in Hollywood. And the Scarecrow got back to me, and the great composer didn't. But it sort of began with these great leaps of imagination to try to contact the great American firmament of art. In that case, you had Hollywood art, and also you had composition. But I wanted to sort of somehow communicate with that world, and the way I could do it as a kid was by picking up a pencil and writing those letters, and then also eventually within years sort of meeting poetry through Emily Dickinson and starting to actually write my own little books like she did and sew them together. And that was all basically before I was 11.
But, you know, the whole business of you first coming to the Writers' Conference,
Howard Koenig, yep.
Howard Koenig. He had the key to the place, and you met him there before he got in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, another thing that I think about here, if that key hadn't turned and if that door hadn't opened, my life would be totally different. And I think I had been invited to join this entire community by accidentally wandering into a Rock Island Arts Council gallery exhibition on the pedestrian mall downtown, and I went in for the free food, for the cake that they were serving, and Dave happened to
that
be there.
Sounds like a writer.
Yeah, Dave Collins was there, and he was eating cake and chewing, and I came up, and he said, well, he said, oh, you know, he was such a welcoming person, and he said, oh, you're here, and, you know, and of course, I was really young to be in an art exhibition. And he said, I said, well, I'm a writer, and, you know, and I'm looking at art. And he said, well, if you're a writer, you need to come to Writer's Studio. And he told me when, and I double-checked that in the meetings page of the Davenport Times, as it was called then. And then I showed up, and that's when Howard had the key. And I sort of depict that at the beginning of the book as a frame. Mm-hmm. The book, in many ways, addresses the life of the child pre-13 or 14, You know, when so many things were happening in the home and the neighborhood and really in the country at that time in the 1970s. And they were all sort of filtering around, and I was trying to find my way through and, you know, found this writing that ended up being a beacon or a flashlight through that sort of very dim and confusing time.
It's interesting. You talk about the Writers Club or whatever it was called, and became the David Collins Writers Conference.
Well, Mississippi Valley Writers Conference.
Mississippi Valley, yeah.
He took it.
That's how I think of it, the right. MVWC, right, yeah. To use an acronym or the military term, Mississippi Valley Writing Conference. And I'm so glad that you saw me there. Now I know I exist. You know,
I taught in that for 10 years. A month ago or so, a local reporter did a really good interview with you on what that writers' conference meant to you. Can you just say a word about, and particularly Dave Collins?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, Dave had many vital collaborators. I'm in the room with some right now. He collaborated freely, fully, equally with lots of different people. But often it was he who was spearheading a charge to do things, whether it was to have a one-day mini-conference at the Butterworth Mansion or to invent this writing conference. And, you know, I learned, you know, I in that article, I talked about different lessons, you know, and one of them was that, you know, writing is innately solitary and sometimes actually even almost nightmarish kind of process. You have to go to deep places and come out of them, hopefully. But, you know, Dave always made it clear that writers should support each other and that from that fellowship came, you know, sort of an eroding of some of those doubts about your right to do it, your need to do it. And just that sense of needing to do something with your writing every day that he just preached, even though he was somebody who had to find very imaginative ways to do that with his teaching and community building. But he would always say, do one thing for your writing every day. Do one thing for your writing every day. It could be picking up a book, picking up a pen, learning a new word, looking up into the sky and thinking about a thought and trying to sharpen it to a point of perception, because thought is not automatically perception. He taught that. And those are the kinds of rules that I've taken forward ever since, and they're like trusty talismans in my pocket. They never wear away. And there's many others, but those are some of the rules that I'll be talking about tonight when I give my speech and how they've, you know, the simplicity is very deceptive because someone has to say them like they really believe them. And Dave believed all of them and he lived them.
I should mention that we're recording this on the day of the opening of the Writers' Conference, and we caught Ben ahead of that keynote address. You know, we don't want to deceive our listeners.
No, and the keynote address sounds like the United Nations, but, you know, we'll see who. I'm sort of daunted by the term keynote address. I'm thinking of it as a conversation, casual conversation with the members of my tribe.
Go ahead.
No, one thing I wouldn't describe your writing as is casual.
No, you know, I mean, not at all.
Yeah. Right.
They speak about athletes being in the zone, but it seems to me from page one to page 500 and some, you are in the zone. And how in the world do you manage to do that? Or is this the result of a lot of rewriting? Is this how it comes out?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The book took over 10 years to write. The book took that long to write because of the difficulty and the complexity of the subject matter for some reasons. It wasn't enough to tell the family story. I wanted to tell the neighborhood story. And I also wanted to tell the community story, the larger story. So, you know, oysters accrete through, you know, layers, you know, a layer of a shell and then a harder layer. And this book sort of accreted like an oyster, you know, sort of one part would come, Mr. Hickey would come, who was a neighbor who was very important to me, and then another part would come after that. And I've always found nothing is always, it's not all there when I do anything. A fragment is always there. And then I get another fragment and I puzzle piece it together and to make what I think is a dense enough and rich enough text or page to actually communicate with the lives we live, which are really almost inexplicable in their density and their meaning, because we're all living amid so many meanings of the present and past at the same time. So I always loved authors like Emerson, or I loved, you know, poets that were able to create these accretions of layers to communicate on different ways with a narrative and come into it from different angles. So that takes a lot of time. And, of course, rewriting is part of it too, because sentences, especially prose, are really hard to tweak to the place where you get them to be like prisms. You know, you want every sentence to be like a prism that can shoot this light in different directions.
But, you know, how do you prepare, since you are a writer? You're a writer, I'm a talker. And to me, those are two different, I won't call mine a discipline, but at least it's two modes of expression. How do you prepare to talk tonight?
Well, you know, it's funny. I really do. I wrote an essay that I'm going to read tonight about the I call it the mission of writing. And I've already touched on a little bit of it here. So I'm going to touch on, you know, how that mission was formed here, being surrounded by the conference and surrounded by Writer Studio and people like yourselves. And again, before we went on mic, I mentioned to Don about that I always see dusk behind him whenever I see him because of his wonderful introductions to the Genesius Guild plays. And I always went to those plays, and I carried them with me, and I got the paperbacks. I go to Harrison Street Bookstore or Read More or The Source and get the books and read the plays. So, you know, I mean, I think from tonight, it comes from both the heart and the mind, but with the mind sharpening the heart and the heart sharpening the mind. So I work for about 3 weeks to create the comments I'll deliver tonight. And they're all going to be about, you know, all in the area we're speaking about here, about how a person can receive messages and gifts at a certain time in their life that end up to be enduring, steadying, and humanizing.
This time I'll jump. One of the things I don't understand, and this is for both you and Roald, are there really that many writers in this community? It seems that this is about our 208th person to talk to. We've had a few repetitions, but 208 people we've talked to that in some way are involved in writing.
Who are all local or have a local.
And they're all local, yeah. All local. How does that happen? I mean, is there something strange about this community?
Well, this has always been, I think, a rich community for writing, hasn't it? And plays.
Oh, right. I mean, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight. But, you know, you go back into the 1890s and Octave Thanet, which was the pen name of Alice French, who was the daughter of the founder of the French and Heck Factory, William Dean Howells, the famous novelist on, you know, he was as famous as Henry James in the 1890s. He took her on as a protege during the Depression era. You had members Susan Glaspell and George Cram Cook, who eventually started the Provincetown Players in Cape Cod, which did Eugene O'Neill's first plays. They came through here. Davenport's mentioned in Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And then you have, you know, the whole idea that 50 miles, you know, into Iowa, you had John Berryman, the poet, Robert Lowell, the poet at Iowa. You had Paul Engle.
Arthur Davison Ficke.
Yeah, right. Arthur Davison Ficke, right. Yep, who was the boyfriend of Edna St. Millay.
Yeah.
So there is sort of, and I sort of, that was somehow real to me because I was sort of a lonely kid who went to bookstores and was pawing around. And I mean, I do think that art, for everybody, can have a meaning, and that's another thing that Dave sort of talked about, that writing at any stage of life, at any level, can have meaning, and I think it's something that you can have total power over in a world of confusion. You know, and this is, often it starts just because you decide to sit down and do it, and how empowering is that? I mean, no one's telling you to do it. Actually, no one wants you to do it. There's already too many voices out there. But the whole act to do it is a real big act of self-affirmation, and there's many reasons to do it. They're all legitimate, if honestly pursued. And you know, so I think we live in the mid-sized cities in the Midwest are really interesting, changeling kind of cultures. And they bring a lot of people together, and it's hard to find the nucleus. And that will, again, lead people to searches for meaning and searches for contact.
Well, the big argument in the Quad Cities is, are we joined by a river or separated by a river? And the answer is sort of both. I think it's time to listen to a little bit of
I agree.
Ben's style, because I have some things to say about it afterwards. And I've taken the liberty of asking him to read a passage that I thought was particularly powerful. You can explain the context of
sure. This yep, I'll do my passage. Best here, and it's great to take a request. I always dreamed of being a musician, actually. So I'm taking a request here from someone in the front row, swirling a twizzle stick in his afternoon drink. Basically, I'm going to read here. The book is cut into three sections. The middle section is really the heart of the book, and it tells the story of a very kind neighbor who would let me in his house and entertain me at his kitchen table when I was a child in need, under age 12. Now, if I hadn't found this neighbor, Mr. Hickey, I never would have found the writing group, because I never would have made it to the age when I found the writing groups, which was about 14 or 15 years old.
Okay, give us a sample. Yep.
So I'm going to read sort of an intro to an essay about Mr. Hickey called The Buttermint Gun. After the Kmart Midnight Madness sale and shared crumble burger at Ross's truck stop, over which mother and I calculated that somewhere between $2 and $20 had been saved on stationery, papermate, pens, canned ham, and other items vital to our way of life. That is to say, after all of our neon shopping options were exhausted, the LTD headed homeward on River Drive. It sounded like there were 100 maracas under the hood, or a 3-foot cricket. Mother pointed out the towel-strung balconies of prostitute motels with innocent names like Shady Grove. And again she drew my attention to the turreted mansion where, quote, the writer named Alice French had once lived before moving to New York City and changing her last name to Octave Thanet at the suggestion of the famous novelist, quote, that beast William Dean Howells. I took mental notes, it being too dark to scrawl anything on the Mead narrow-ruled notebook spread across my lap. Beyond the railroad tracks, the Mississippi glistened like a greasy skillet, and the howitzer factories on Arsenal Island were busy producing America's gift to Latin America. The car climbed Middle Road and plunged down the alley, pushing through darkness and pushed by the darkness, behind which flowed still more darkness, inky tides of night filling the trench formed by cottage-style garages and spilling over back terraces, save for the one above our own, lit by bulbs which cut the murk in the manner of police boat beams. The best thing about arrival was this brightness, which promised safety, and Mr. Hickey, insomniac pilot of the terrace above ours. He would be sporting his pistol, loaded with buttermints that would turn sweet whomever they shot. The worst thing about arriving home was home, the ragged, trash-strewn hedges along the retaining wall, the splintery back stoop with its love seat webbed by trumpet vines, the screen door mesh curling off its frame like the frayed outfit of a pirate skeleton. "Let's go see Mr. Hickey," I said. "Good idea, Benji." Blomp! The bumper hit the frame of the doorless garage.
That is real, I think, good writing. My preference is when I taught American Lit, my preference was for the plain style, you know, made famous by Mark Twain and carried on by Hemingway and others. But then I read something like this, and I'm back on the other side with Cormac McCarthy and William Faulkner.
Thomas Wolfe.
Thomas Wolfe, right? Yeah. I mean, they're two big threads in American Lit. One, you know, follows Twain, and the other, yeah. But when you get really good writing of this kind, to me, it's symphonic.
You know, what I like is a throwaway line like the howitzer factory, our gift to Latin America.
Right.
That is wonderful.
Right.
That is a phrase that just stops you right there.
Anyway, the book reads like a symphony, right? There's a prologue instead of an overture, but it's the same,
yeah,
same kind of thing.
And it is rich and dense in the best sense that you can pull all sorts of things out of that, but the detail that you go into. Did you actually remember that? Did you have to go look at it again?
Well, you know, I in my pocket here I'm taking out note cards, and I've been taking notes since I was a child compulsively. I make notes and I lose notes about thoughts and sights that I'm seeing. I am quite visual, so I really like to sort of take pictures with my mind about things. So things that were happening when I was young, and you'll find this out with kids that come from houses that are sort of in chaos. Their sensory apparatus gets overwhelmed, but it's also sharpened to a degree. So you feel you're always in survival mode, and that causes you to focus on things, the things you focus on, with extreme intensity. And, you know, I didn't have my notes from when I was young, but I had them in my heart and my mind. And so what I would do when I would start to say, oh, I need to write about Mr. Hickey. He was before everything. He was before the writing group. He's a key to who I am and who I might be. So I would, you know, write a 3-page draft, and then I would see what would come out, and then I'd take some things out, and then I'd write more. And again, it's that process of accretion. And again, it is Baroque, and you might say a beatific kind of blowhardism, but I think it's the sense that I've always thought of life as a mess, and the junkification, the subtitle of the book is The Junkification of a Boyhood Idol Amid the Curious Glory of Urban Iowa. There's a torque between our chintzy consumerism and reality with the ideals of America. And this torque is really intense. And every house has to deal with this torque. And sometimes things align and there's less junkification. Sometimes, though, there's more junkification. And I think the density of the book is to get this, get across a child's sense of clutter. They're doing great over there. We're down here. They're in the middle over there. How does this make sense? You go to school, certain kids got certain kind of treatment, other kids got other kind of treatment. What's going on? Is everyone just confused? What's malevolent about it? What's not malevolent about it? So I think the density is far from, it's about actually an author trying to work out or mediate a negotiation with the reality and the experiences that he's seen, and really not wanting to leave out the mess and the complications.
You know, it's interesting because as you say that, I think of my own childhood. I did not express myself in any way, but I observed all that and I just kept it inside and didn't talk to anybody about it. It's interesting that the things that went on in my head, you could not judge from my behavior. There was just no way. There's no relationship between the two.
And that poker face is a really important thing as a writer. I was teased a lot when I was a kid, so I got a poker face. And so, but I think that there's a use for a poker face in society because, you know, everyone can be rash, and you have time then to process what you're thinking and feeling and seeing. And then, you know, there's always a time to speak, and it's important to speak. But you're right, that sense of sometimes there's a complete disconnection with what people will see on the outside and what's going on the inside for a variety of different reasons. And that's a fascinating thing that everyone lives with to a certain degree.
I in fact, read your book when it first came out because somebody else who'd read it before me said it contained the phrase, the taciturn Dick Stahl. And I thought, that is right on the money. I got to read this book.
And, you know, God love Dick. He's a wonderful poet and everything. But as a child, I was puzzled. So I used the words that a child, right, you know, and searching for words and trying to see all these people. I was, a child, as my friend to my right here said, I was younger than everyone by 30 years. And no one gave me any tools to understand what everyone was saying. So, you know, there were people that were taciturn or stern. And, of course, Dick Stahl was an AP English teacher at Central High.
Right.
I was reading Allen Ginsberg at the time. I thought I had the only copy of Howl.
Right.
It was black and white. I thought it was hand-printed in Davenport. I didn't know. And, you know, I was reading this wild free verse. And he represented, you know, this pretty much of the status quo of what was going on. And then, of course, he attended Writer's Studio, and I found out all these other sides of him. So
right.
It was a wonderful thing to see adults in the school setting, and then in the Writer's Studio setting. But everybody mentioned in the book is someone who has been with me and been walking with me ever since, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's it is interesting. River Bend Chronicle, by the way, is the name of the book that we've been talking about, and we're talking to the author Ben Miller on the occasion of his giving the keynote address for this summer's Writers' Conference, and which happened about 5 weeks ago, I guess, something like that. But we were able to snag Ben. I want to know, are you still writing?
It's my being, basically. I'd write, you know, even if I didn't have hands, I'd probably put a pen in my mouth and write. Writing is the way of living in and being in the world. And I've got a number of projects in process. This book only goes up really through 13 and 14 if you take away the prologue. So it's lots of stories in my teenage years I'd like to tell, including some about the writing conference that we were at together.
You know, it's you reminded me of a remarkable movie, of a book about a man who was afflicted with some kind of thing that the only thing he could control was the blinking of one eye.
I think that's the Butterfly Book.
Yeah, the Butterfly Book. He wrote by having someone recite the letters of the alphabet, and they hit one, he'd blink, and then he'd go to the next letter. And there was a man who was determined to write.
Absolutely.
The impulse to write is one I don't quite understand because I don't have that impulse. But I'm amazed that there are people like you who seem to write all the time. Do you write every day?
Yeah, it's a daily practice. My wife is a poet, and we've been married 30 years. Ann Pearson Weiss, I met her at NYU in the graduate writing program, and we both have offices and around day jobs. At various times, you know, we've always written, and then every once in a while we get a fellowship or a grant, and then we have 9 months or a year and we can just write, and then we go on to keep on moving. So, again, it's a way to be in the world. And I think it was David R. Collins' way to be in the world. And going to the writing group, I saw other people that were like that. And I thought, okay, that's fine. If I need to write and make notes on napkins, and that's fine. And if I need to read all of these things and, you know, and study everyone from Copeland to Ray Bolger, then I need to do that. That's part of who I am. But it's all art-based. And, you know, art is a thing that makes life have this depth that it wouldn't have otherwise. It's very humanizing.
Yeah, and I'm happy to say it just goes on. The Writers' Conference continues. The writers still coalesce, so they have regular meetings. There's also the Quint City Poets, which Roald is going to go to if I have to drive him myself. But the collection of writers and the camaraderie of writers in this area is just remarkable. And it's good you have a chance to come back and connect with them again.
And I'm trying to spread it around the globe, basically. my wife's going to be in Paris next year on a fellowship, and I'm going to be going over there, and I'll be talking about Writer's Studio, actually. Those people are with me wherever I go, and I hope to come back and reconnect here sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, it's an opportunity that you shouldn't pass up. That's where all the writers used to go, isn't it?
Right.
Over to Paris and, I don't know, drink absinthe and sit around and smoke little cigarettes. Do you have a comparable group in out east?
Well, you know, what my wife and I, we meet every couple weeks or months and read, you know, what we're working on. And basically now I work through journals. So I submit heavily, and then when a piece gets taken, it's you work with a great editor, and that sort of replaces the process that I had at Writer's Studio. But nothing actually could replace that group.
Okay, well, we're glad you came back and reconnected here, and I'm sure people will have enjoyed, because this recording is made before the speech, and then you're hearing it about 5 weeks later. Thank you very much, Ben Miller.
Yep.
Appreciate the visit.
Yeah, thank you. Keep on.
And that'll do it for now. I'm Don Wooten with Roald Tweet. This goes on. We'll be back next week for another edition of Scribble.